This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd. President Joe Biden on Wednesday announced plans for a Pentagon review of national security strategy on China as part of his push to recalibrate the U.S. approach with Beijing. The president announced the review during his first visit to the Pentagon as commander-in-chief.
The task force will work quickly, drawing on civilian and military experts across the department to provide within the next few months recommendations to Senator Austin on key priorities and decision points so that we can chart a strong path forward on China-related matters.
Defense Department officials described the review as a sprint effort that would weigh U.S. intelligence, troop levels in the region, defense alliances with China, and more. Biden is determined to depart from former President Donald Trump's approach to China, a relationship that placed economic and trade concerns above all else and then hit a wall after the coronavirus pandemic. President Joe Biden on Wednesday ordered new sanctions against the military regime in Myanmar, taking action after the military this month staged a coup in the Southeast Asian country and arrested de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other senior politicians. Biden said he was issuing an executive order that will prevent Myanmar's generals from accessing $1 billion in assets in the United States.
So today, I'm announcing a series of actions that we're taking to begin imposing consequences on the leaders of the coup.
The president said the United States and a broad international coalition are calling on military leaders to free political detainees. He said that the people of Myanmar are demanding that power be restored to the civilian government. On Wall Street, a mixed day with the Dow Jones Industrials up, but the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ lower. This is VOA News. House Democrats have wrapped up their first full day of arguments at the historic second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Democrats finished their presentation Wednesday night after 7 hours. They presented security footage, social media videos, police radio calls, and Trump's own Twitter posts to argue that he stoked the flames of violence and incited the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Democratic prosecutor David Cicilline says that Trump was derelict in his duty when he failed to protect senators and congressmen from the mob.
The people around Donald Trump lobbied him to take command. What's also clear is what Donald Trump, our commander-in-chief, did in those initial hours to protect us. Nothing. Not a thing.
President Trump's lawyer, Bruce Castor, says that Wednesday's hearing failed to cover anything new.
Mob violence is something that President Trump abhors, so we didn't learn anything today we didn't already know. As a matter of fact, I wonder why we sat through 8 hours of videos that aren't under dispute.
Wednesday was the first full day of arguments at the trial, with House prosecutors focusing on the aftermath of Trump's urging his supporters to fight like hell over his election loss to Democrat Joe Biden. Prominent women's rights activist Lujain Al-Hathlu was released from a Saudi prison Wednesday after nearly 3 years behind bars in a case that has drawn international attention. Reuters' Lisa Bernhardt has more.
In a case that has drawn international condemnation, 31-year-old Halul was detained in May of 2018 and sentenced in December to nearly 6 years in prison for allegedly seeking to change the Saudi political system and harming national unity, charges UN human rights experts called spurious. Halul had campaigned for a woman's right to drive and to end Saudi's male guardianship system. Rights groups and her family say Halul, who was detained with several other women's rights activists, was subjected to abuse, including electric shocks, waterboarding, flogging, and sexual assault. Saudi authorities denied the accusations and gave no immediate comment on her release. The White House has said President Joe Biden expects Riyadh to improve its human rights record, including releasing political prisoners.
That report from Reuters' Lisa Bernhardt. Visit voanews.com for more. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN condemns Wednesday's attack on 20 UN peacekeepers in central Mali.
It is very sad that tragic incidents occur with peacekeepers, but as you may know, such attacks spare no one, including civilians who have no choice but to run for their lives.
Uganda's government restores social media sites except Facebook. The International Red Crescent Societies appeals for more humanitarian assistance for Ethiopia's Tigray region. The people of Kenya's Kisumu County petitioned for help after rains destroyed their temporary homes. And a ruling is expected today whether Ghana's Electoral Commission chair should be made to testify.
Initially, she had given indications she'll be testifying by doing a number of things, but she subsequently decided not to testify. So that is why it has become a big problem.
And today, Thursday, is the International Day of Women and Girls in Science. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The UN Stabilization Mission in Mali, also known as MINUSMA, is condemning an attack this week on 20 UN peacekeepers in central Mali. This comes after four other peacekeepers were killed in the country last month. Amid the insecurity are hundreds of thousands of refugees and internally displaced people struggling with food insecurity and violence. Chadi Oanes, the spokesperson for UNHCR in Mali, gives viewers Ayen Deng Bio a look at the humanitarian situation in Mali.
The humanitarian situation in Mali has been worsening due to armed conflicts, intercommunal clashes, and the effects of climatic shocks. So all these elements combined together have resulted in a deep humanitarian crisis in the country at many levels. For instance, last year alone, there were 13,000 Malians internally displaced monthly due to persecution and violence. And also 50% of the total refugee population in Mali have arrived in 2020 alone. I would also like to mention that the pandemic of COVID-19 and also the socio-political crisis have added a layer to the situation of Malians who have already been suffering from their human rights violations and food shortage, also the impact of the climate change.
And what is causing this insecurity and how has it impacted people?
Insecurity in Mali is mainly the fruit of the presence of unbridled armed groups that have been persecuting civilians. Also, conflicts between and within communities have been preventing peaceful coexistence. However, as you may know, insecurity is not just about physical or psychological integrity. For instance, food shortage, the inability to access to basic services, the effects of climate change are also considered to be insecurity because they leave thousands of Malian households in dire conditions and even in certain about what tomorrow holds for them or for their children.
Four peacekeepers were killed in Mali. What's your reaction?
It is very sad that tragic incidents occur with peacekeepers, but also with humanitarians who face the exact same risks and those who have been victims of similar incidents while they were delivering aid in very dangerous areas. But as you may know, that such attacks spare no one, including civilians who have no choice but to run for their lives to look for safety or security. But I also must confess that our response is really becoming overstretched because of that. So despite all of this, we will continue to respond to the needs. However, I still am convinced that the situation can be reversed if, for example, security efforts, forces step up their efforts to protect civilians, if donors increase their contributions, and if warring parties cease the violence so that they live and let live.
And what's the UN's long-term humanitarian strategy in Mali?
That is a good question. All I can say is that we do project and we do try to strategize on the mid to long term. For instance, our current strategy is focusing on priority issues related to protection, to gender-based violence, education, and the effects of climate change. And we also try to work within a multi-partner framework so that we can find durable solutions to the persons we serve. But also from a wider perspective, I think that we are at a point where the world is changing so fast and the development gap is really widening. So the humanitarian work should instead be a pathway towards development, because refugees and forcibly displaced persons, such as anyone else, deserve a chance to thrive, not just survive.
That was Chadis Ouanes, spokesperson for UNHCR in Mali, speaking to viewers Ayen Deng Biol. The president of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is expressing concern about the humanitarian situation in Mekelle City of Ethiopia's Tigray region as a result of recent fighting between the Ethiopian military and the TPLF. Francesco Roca, who has just completed a visit to Mekelle, says internally displaced people need much more aid than they are currently receiving. He says hospitals in the city lack basic medical supplies. Roca tells me that there is a need to increase humanitarian assistance to meet the needs of the people.
I visited only Mekelle and not the rural areas and the other cities. Mekelle, more or less, is like a normal city yesterday and the day before yesterday. But the hospitals, they have run out of medicines and drugs. I visited two hospitals and they have no patients in because they have no drugs and medicine to treat them or to make surgery. And even I visited the one of them was a maternal one. They only are natural delivery because they don't have any kind of surgical support. So the situation is something very, very delicate looking at the health system, even because it is really broken. Only four hospitals in the region out of 40 are working, but working in the way that I just told you. They are completely stopped. And some of them have been damaged, or other health facilities have been damaged or looted. And this is something, a big reason of concern.
Previously, they have been concerned about accessibility to the region. How did you find accessibility?
Access in Mekelle, also in Adigato-Jire and Adwa is improving about the main roads, but still the rural areas are really insecure. And still is not, we are waiting for the green light. This is, we have been promised, but not only us, other international organizations had received the same commitment from the government that will allow to the flights. But at the moment, we are still waiting the first flight to arrive. So this is it's another reason of concern, because access to the rural areas, but also receiving aid needed to support the millions in need is a question of really of time, and we do need to scale up the activities because I've talked only about health, but it's also about food. We have reports of several cases of malnutrition, especially amongst children, and this again, once again, is unacceptable. And I've met I visited one IDP center in Mekelle, one of the several, because there are 250,000 IDPs living in Mekelle, only in Mekelle, but there are other IDPs camps in Adigrat and mostly in Shire, and the stories are really very, very sad.
They have been concerned about the impact of this conflict on not just Mekelle, but the entire region. I mean, how would you describe the impact on the region?
At the moment, the impact is a severe one because, you know, Sudan is hosting thousands and thousands of refugees. So the dynamic in the region remain very volatile and very complex because this about the rumors of other actors coming from other states within Tigray operating. These are the kind of situation that can bring even to most difficult situations in the next future. Let me put it this way. I am here to assess the needs, and I don't want to be involved in the political dynamic. But if they don't assess the needs of the IDPs, the needs of the Tigray people, and there will be an international political dialogue about what is happening on the ground, the risk of an escalation is very high.
That was Francisco Roca, president of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. He was speaking with us from Addis Ababa. Ugandan authorities restored access to the internet on Wednesday, a month after blocking it ahead of the January 14 elections. The government said the disruption was needed for security, while critics say it was intended to cut off communication among opponents of President Yoweri Museveni. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
In a tweet Wednesday, Ugandan Minister for Information and Communications Technology, Peter Gwang, said internet and social media services have been fully restored. He added, "We apologize for the inconveniences caused, but it was for the security of our country." Government spokesman Ofwono Opondo says the shutdown was a method of war against elements that were a threat to the credibility of the elections. He says since those threats have been greatly neutralized, the government has restored access to social media websites, with the exception of Facebook.
We have released elements of social media, Twitter, Instagram, WhatsApp, because we think to a less extent, those are not as little as Facebook. So we shall examine going forward their posture on these other social media platforms that have been released, and that will inform how soon Facebook is restored.
Before the January 14th elections, President Museveni ordered the blocking of Facebook following reports that the company had shut down 220 accounts linked to the Ministry of Information and Communications Technology. Facebook said the accounts were fakes or duplicates being used to make posts by President Yoweri Museveni and his son, Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, appear more popular than they were. Some posts from the accounts also targeted the opposition National Unity Platform Party and its presidential candidate, Bobi Wine. National Unity Platform Party spokesperson Joel Senyonyi says Facebook was right to shut down the accounts.
Government continues to have a grip on social media because they want to control free speech, because they know that Ugandans pretty much have social media as the avenue for their free expression. And that's why Facebook did carry out its investigations, because there was a lot of propaganda churned out by those government-run social media accounts.
Michael Nitegeka, an information technology expert, says the shutdown of Facebook is hurting many Ugandans' livelihoods because they rely on the social media site for marketing.
Because they don't have the resources to go to radio, they don't have the resources to go on TV, so their businesses largely depend on the Facebook market.
Dorothy Mukasa, Chief Executive Officer of Unwanted Witness, a digital rights organization, is calling for lawmakers to establish rules on internet access.
So what we should be doing as Ugandans is to continue to put government to account. Now, why did they shut down the internet? And also ask institutions like parliament or judiciary to put in place guidelines, because this is bound to happen over and over. Can we have guidelines in place, or even a law that will stipulate when should the internet be disrupted?
In the meantime, Ugandans continue to use virtual private networks to access Facebook without paying a social media tax introduced by the government in July 2018. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butty in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 11th. Ghana's Supreme Court is expected to rule today, Thursday, whether Electoral Commission Chairperson Jean Adukwe Mesa should testify and be cross-examined about the December 7, 2020 presidential election. Mesa and her commission are first responding to former President John Dramani Mahama's petition challenging the results of the election. Her lawyer says Supreme Court guidelines preclude her from testifying. However, attorney Martin Bwebu, a Ghanaian lawyer, says Mrs. Mesa had first said she would testify before changing her mind.
Initially, she had given indications she'll be testifying by doing a number of things, but she subsequently decided not to testify. So that is why it has become a big problem. When it was really time to testify, then she said she wasn't going to do it.
What are some of the reasons for her decision not to testify?
She's not testifying because she thinks the plaintiff, that is to say the petitioner, has not made out a good case for her to even respond. In other words, she's saying the case the petitioner has presented so far is extremely weak. There's no way that case will pass muster. So because it is so weak, she doesn't even need to testify. The petitioner will fall on his own sword, so to speak.
I understand former President Mahama's legal team are claiming that perhaps the Elections Commission chair does not want to testify because she does not want to be held accountable.
Yes, that is correct. So their arguments sound reasonable because the whole petition is about the accountability. So she made some errors in the declaration of the results. So that is quite a crucial part of the petition. And then the second part of the petition is that Mr. Mahama is based on the mistake she made in the compilation of the results. If the right thing were actually done, none of the two contenders, that is to say Mr. Mahama and the second president, President Nana Akufo-Addo, would have made the 50+1% of votes that is required. So in other words, none of them would have won the election if the Electoral Commissioner had done the right thing in compiling the results.
What do you think is the popular view now in Ghana about this particular issue? How do you think the Supreme Court might rule in this matter?
In terms of measuring the general mood and reaction, it appears this one too, we are split down the middle in election results. What you find is that supporters of Mr. Mahama are definitely in favor of the chairperson taking the stand. And the supporters of the president, Nana Akufo-Addo, are also against her taking the stand. So it's just basically gone back to the pattern of the results. Those in favor of her taking the stand are for Mr. Mahama. Those against are for the sitting president.
How independent do you think the Ghanaian Supreme Court is?
It's sufficiently independent to give an opinion. Yes, they are sufficiently independent. Naturally, in matters like this, independence is relative. The judges are paid by the government, but that is the same everywhere. So what you find is that those who are in support of Mr. Mahama generally will say the judges are biased. But the context is that, you know, Mr. Mahama won a similar petition in 2012, you know, in 2012, when he won that election, the current president took the case to court. But Mr. Mahama won it. So the court decided that, look, his election was valid. He won it. He said. But today, you'll find his supporters throwing jabs at the court, saying that they are biased. Mr. Mahama is not getting a fair hearing. So all I'm saying is that a lot of it is political speech. But in reality, the judges are sufficiently independent.
That was Martin Bwebu, a Ghanaian lawyer, speaking with us from the capital, Accra. Hundreds of families in Kenya's Kisumu County were forced to spend the night in the cold after heavy rains destroyed their temporary structures. The residents who are currently relying on help from humanitarian aid organizations became homeless after their structures were demolished to make way for the rehabilitation of the Nakuru-Kisumu railway line. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, a two-year-old died when a wall collapsed on him during the demolition.
The demolitions on a 100-acre of land took place under the cover of darkness, catching the victims by surprise. At the break of dawn, hundreds of families had been left homeless. Rela Chieng, one of the victims, says they were unable to salvage anything as property of unknown value was destroyed. She further says the evictions took place under tight security, with police officers lobbing tear gas canisters at those who tried to resist. She says at around 8 p.m. the guys arrived with bulldozers and they did not even ask us to get our things out first but started demolishing our houses with everything inside. All my things have been destroyed and I have nothing left. Even if the government wants to evict us, they should at least give us some time to salvage our belongings. We have nowhere to go and we have young children who are cold and hungry. The police lobbied tear gas canisters at us when we tried to plead with them to let us salvage our belongings, she says. The exercise has drawn criticism from Kisumu County Governor Professor Anyang' Nyong'o, who led other leaders in condemning it. saying it was conducted in the most inhumane way. He says that the Kenya Railways Corporation carried out the demolitions without his knowledge.
And we are not going to stand again seeing this shameful act in the history of our people. I was very surprised when this thing was done without reference to me, without reference to the city manager, without reference to anybody in the county government, notwithstanding what His Excellency had said.
Human rights groups have filed a case at the Kisumu Law Court seeking to compel the government to compensate the affected families. Amnesty International Executive Director in Kenya, Hilton Irungu, has called on the government to stop any forced evictions during coronavirus pandemic. A two-year-old lost his life during the demolition after a wall collapsed on him.
The other thing, and the very last thing that it needs to do, is it needs to declare a moratorium on all forced evictions in this country until the pandemic is over. We can't have people homeless in the elements during a pandemic. The second thing that they can do is begin to implement the 2009 guidelines on evictions and resettlement. It is extremely clear what a government needs to do in order to move people for infrastructural development. Somebody has to be held accountable. We know that one child is dead. That child was not lost in the operation. That child was killed in the process of removing people from their homes without due care and concern.
Kenya Railways says the demolition was necessary to reclaim its land near the railway line to pave way for rehabilitation of the Nakuru-Kisumu railway line. The victims have called on President Uhuru Kenyatta to intervene by giving them permanent shelters following displacement from the only homes they have known. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Today, Thursday, is the International Day of Women and Girls in Science Day. The United Nations says gender inequality has limited women from achieving their potential in science and effectively contributing to development challenges. The theme of this year's commemoration is Women Scientists at the Forefront of the Fight Against COVID-19. Marie Odhiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, on African women in science.
Women scientists have a critical role to play in Africa's development and pushing for gender equality. Gender biases and stereotypes embedded in science institutions create an often challenging work environment for women scientists. However, some women have made tremendous achievements in this field, mostly dominated by men. Melissa Kapulu is a Zambian working in Kenya as a researcher at the Kenya Medical Research Institute, specifically developing malaria vaccine. She says, when she started her career, being a woman has always been the main obstacle she has to overcome.
What I can say is that when I first went to Oxford, the things that came against you, other than just the fact that you were female, was that you were an African. However, I think it's important we begin to look at those challenges as opportunities, as I have said. We are always in the minority, and science is not very well developed on the continent. A few countries are doing very well to bring science, and there is need, there's a concerted effort to actually encourage the girl child to take STEM subjects.
Kapulu is among the 30% of women in research and development in sub-Saharan Africa. She said that it has been difficult for her to balance between parenthood and career in science as a female, and that championing for space for women in science is crucial in her field of science.
It's a bit difficult to juggle parenthood and a career as a female, and more especially career in science where you're expected to be at the bench, so in a lab working to develop your various research endeavors. It's really encouraging to see that women are coming together and there's more support systems that are coming along. Despite it still be really male-dominated career, we have those pillars in our careers or people who can sort of rally around us and provide the support system.
In many African countries, university departments and research institutes are often led by men who also occupy key leadership positions of responsibility. A Kenyan scientist who is also an oncologist and assistant professor surgery department at Aga Khan University, Kenya, Dr. Miriam Mutebi, said that improved enabling environment for women in science will help women achieve more. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Odhiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this Thursday, February 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butter in Washington, saying, have a great day.